Chapter 24, Money. Page 180. Nature and definition of money. There has been a lot of controversy and confusion over the meaning and nature of money, as pointed out by Skatowski. Money is a difficult concept to define, partly because it fulfills not one but three functions, each of them providing a criteria of moneyness: those of a unit of account, a medium of exchange, and a store of value. Note 1. T. Skatowski, Money and the Balance of Payments, 1969. Though Skatowski points towards the difficulty of defining money due to moneyness, note 2. Moneyness means liquidity. All things which possess liquidity have moneyness. For its detailed study, refer to the chapter The Supply of Money. Yet he gives a wide definition of money. Kolbon defines money as the means of valuation and of payment, as both the unit of account and the generally acceptable medium of exchange. Kolbon's definition is very wide. He includes in it the concrete money such as gold, checks, coins, currency notes, bank drafts, etc., and also abstract money, which is the vehicle of our thoughts of value, price, and worth. Such wide definitions have led Sir John Hicks to say that money is defined by its functions. Anything is money which is used as money. Money is what money does. Note 3. John Hicks, Critical Essay in Monetary Theory, 1967. These are the functional definitions of money because they define money in terms of the functions it performs. Some economists define money in legal terms, saying that anything which the state declares as money is money. Such money possesses general applicability and has the legal power to discharge debts. But people may not accept legal money by refusing to sell goods and services against the payment of legal tender money. On the other hand, they may accept some other things as money which are not legally defined as money in exchange of debts which may circulate freely. Such things are checks and notes issued by commercial banks. Thus, besides legality, there are other determinants which go to make a thing to serve as money. Theoretical and empirical definitions of money. There being no unanimity over the definition of money, Professor Johnson, Note 4, H. G. Johnson, Monetary Theory and Policy, AER, Volume 52, June 1962. He distinguishes four main schools of thought in this regard, which are discussed below along with the views of Pesek and Saving. 1. The traditional definition of money. According to the traditional view, also known as the view of the currency school, money is defined as currency and demand deposits, and its most important function is to act as a medium of exchange. Keynes, in his general theory, followed the traditional view and defined money as currency and demand deposits. Hicks, in his critical essays in monetary theory, points towards a threefold traditional classification of the nature of money: to act as a unit of account or measure of value, as Wicksell put it, as a means of payment, and as a store of value. The banking school criticized the traditional definition of money as arbitrary. This view about the meaning of money is very narrow because there are other assets which are equally acceptable as media of exchange. This include time deposits of commercial banks, commercial bills of exchange, etc. Page 181. By ignoring these assets, the traditional view is not in a position to analyze their influence in increasing their velocity. Further, by excluding them from the definition of money, the Keynesians place a greater emphasis on the interest elasticity of the demand function for money. Empirically, they forged a link between the stock of money and output via the rate of interest. 2. Friedman's definition of money. The monetarist or Chicago View is associated with Friedman and his followers at the University of Chicago. By money, Friedman means literally the number of dollars people are carrying around in their pockets, the number of dollars they have to their credit at banks in the form of demand deposits and commercial bank time deposits. Note 5. M. Friedman, Employment, Growth and Price Level, 1959. Thus he defines money as the sum of currency plus all adjusted deposits in commercial banks. This is the working definition of money which Friedman and Schwartz used for the empirical study of the monetary trend of US for selected year 1929, 1935, 1950, 1955 and 1960. This was a narrower definition of money, and the adjustment in both demand and time deposits of commercial banks was devised to take into account the increasing financial sophistication of the commercial banks and the community. But Friedman could not establish a single index of this sophistication. Even with this adjustment, cash and deposit monies were not strictly comparable over long periods. However, the correlation evidence for 1950, 1955 and 1960 suggested a broader definition of money as any asset capable of serving as a temporary abode of purchasing power. So Friedman gives two types of definitions of money, one on theoretical basis and the other on empirical basis. This led to a lot of controversy which Friedman tried to solve on the basis of methodological issues. According to him, the definition of money is to be sought for not on grounds of principle but on grounds of usefulness in organizing our knowledge of economic relationships. Thus, the definition used for empirical purposes is unimportant because different definitions will give different results. The empirical results will ultimately depend upon the nature of assets included in the definition of money as a temporary abode of purchasing power. Thus concludes Friedman, the selection of a specific empirical counterpart to the term money seems to us a matter of convenience for a particular purpose, not a matter of principle. Note 6. M. Friedman and A. J. Schwartz, Monetary Statistics of the United States, 1970. He is therefore not rigid in his definition of money and takes a broader view which includes bank deposits, non-bank deposits and any other type of assets through which the monetary authority influences the future level of income, prices, employment or any other important macro variable. 3. The Radcliffe Definition. The Radcliffe Committee, Note 7, Report of the Committee on the Working of Monetary System, 1959. So the Radcliffe Committee defined money as notes plus bank deposits. It includes as money only those assets which are commonly used as media of exchange. Assets refer to liquid assets, by which it means the monetary quantity influencing total effective demand for goods and services. This is interpreted widely to include credit. Thus, the whole liquidity position is relevant to spending decisions. Spending is not limited to cash or money in the bank, but to the amount of money people think they can get hold of either by selling an asset or by borrowing or by receipts of income from, say, sales. The committee did not make use of the concept of velocity of circulation because, as a numerical constant, it is devoid of any behavioral content. On the basis of crude empirical tests, the committee did not find either direct or indirect link between money and economic activity via the interest rate. But it gave a new transmission mechanism based on liquidity. It explained that a movement of interest rates implies significant changes in the capital value of many assets held by financial institutions. A rise in the interest rates makes some less willing to lend because capital values have fallen, and others because their own interest rate structure is sticky. A fall in interest rates, on the other hand, strengthens balance sheets and encourages lenders to seek new business. 4. The Gurley-Shaw definition. Gurley and Shaw, note 8. J. G. Gurley and E. S. Shaw, Money in a Theory of Finance, 1960. Gurley and Shaw regard a substantial volume of liquid assets held by financial intermediaries and the liabilities of non-bank intermediaries as close substitutes for money. Intermediaries provide substitutes for money as a store of value. Money proper, which is defined as equal to currency plus demand deposits, is only one liquid asset. They have thus formulated a wider definition of money based upon liquidity, which includes bonds, insurance reserves, pension funds, savings, and loan shares. They believe in the velocity of money stock, which is influenced by non-bank intermediaries. Their views on the definition of money are based on their own and Goldsmith's empirical findings. Page 182. 5. The Pesek and Saving definition. According to Pesek and Saving, note 9, B.P. Pesek and T.R. Saving, Money, Wealth and Economic Theory, 1967. Money should include demand deposits of banks as well as money issued by the government. They exclude time and saving deposits from bank money. They regard total money, which includes demand deposits, as net wealth of society. They contrast money with debt. Money does not pay interest, but debt yields interest. Debt itself is not wealth, because those who hold bank money consider it as an asset, while bank considers it as an effective liability. Thus, Pesek Saving follow a usable definition of money, which consists of three conditions. First, they regard commodity money and fiat money as assets to their holders and liabilities to no one. Second, the government grants monopoly rights to commercial banks to produce money, who in turn exercise it by selling bank money for the private debts of individuals. Individuals who hold bank money fully consider it as an asset. On the other hand, banks consider it as an effective liability. Thus, Pesek Saving regard bank money less reserves, which bank holds to meet the demand of their depositors, as a net asset of the economy. In the balance sheet, bank money is shown as an asset and private debts as a liability. Third, if it is costless to produce bank money and no interest payments are made on deposits, the net worth of the bank remains unchanged because both assets and liabilities increase by the same amount. This shows that the bank has zero net worth. Pesek Saving do not include time and saving deposits in bank money, but when interest payments are involved, they are included in bank money. They argue that once these deposits start paying interest, they will continue to serve as money. According to Friedman and Schwartz, the logic of Pesek Saving position is that money as net wealth ought to be high-powered money, which the latter rejected as too narrow. It is thus high-powered money or the monetary base which satisfies Pesek Saving first criteria. Patinkin finds some confusion in Pesek Saving analysis when they exclude time and saving deposits from bank money. Pesek Saving also criticizes the traditional methods of accounting used by banks. But Patinkin explains their analysis of money creation in traditional accounting and finds it more useful. Pesek Saving have been criticized for double counting bank money in defining social wealth. First, they include it as part of the money supply, and then they include the net worth of the banking system in another entity. In fact, one or the other should be counted and not both. Despite these criticisms, the views of Pesek and Saving on money are important because they study net worth which accrues to commercial banks. Money and near money. Money consists of currency and bank deposits. Coins and currency notes issued by the central bank of a country and checks of commercial banks of a country are liquid assets. In fact, checks and bank drafts are almost perfect substitutes for money. This is because they perform the medium of exchange function of money. But checks and drafts can be issued at a short notice only in the case of demand deposits. This is not the case with time deposits, which can be withdrawn either at the end of the fixed period or by giving a prior notice to the bank and incurring a penalty. Thus, time deposits are not real money, and for them to become money, they must be converted into cash or demand deposits. However, they are near money, for they can be converted into real money in a short period without any loss. For example, a time deposit of rupees 10,000 for 3 years can always be converted into demand deposit or rupees 10,000 in cash at any time before the completion of 3 years. They also fetch a fixed rate of interest, which may be reduced if the deposit is converted into cash or demand deposit before the expiry of the fixed period. Thus, near money assets serve the store of value function of money temporarily and are convertible into a medium of exchange in a short time without loss in their face value. Besides time deposits, other near money assets are bonds, securities, debentures, bills of exchange, treasury bills, insurance policies, etc. All these types of assets have a market and are negotiable so that they can be converted into real money within a short time. We discuss how these negotiable instruments are near money. Bonds, securities, and debentures fall in the same category. Bonds and securities are issued by the government, while debentures are issued by companies. They are the means to borrow funds for short, medium, or long periods and carry a fixed rate of interest. They are near money assets because they are convertible into cash at a short notice in the money market. Page 183. A bill of exchange is another form of money. It is an IOU, within bracket IOU. It is drawn by an individual or a firm to pay a stated sum of money on a specified date, which is never more than 90 days. A bill of exchange is not money by itself, but it is certainly money on the due date. It is, however, near money if its owner wishes to turn it into cash. It can be easily converted into money at a discount or by receiving less money than its face value. Treasury bills issued by the government also fall in the category of near money. A treasury bill is a promise by the government to pay a stated sum in the near future, usually 30, 60, or 90 days. A treasury bill is also like a bill of exchange, which is convertible into money at a discount within a short period. Life insurance policy is another example of near money. The holder of a life insurance policy can obtain cash in the form of loan on his policy at a short notice. Thus, a life insurance policy is a form of liquid asset which can be regarded near money. Besides these recognized instruments of near money, some intermediaries have come into existence to provide a market for certain assets. Such intermediaries are financial companies which provide funds on the security of some assets, and brokers who buy and sell property, bonds, debentures, shares, etc. They help in increasing the liquidity of such assets, thereby converting them into near money. Money and near money can now be distinguished. Money is a legal tender and gives the possessor liquidity in hand. It performs the medium of exchange function. On the other hand, near money assets do not have any legal status. They possess moneyness or liquidity, but not ready liquidity like money. They are almost perfect substitutes for money as a store of value. They are superior to money because they yield income. They also economize in the use of money proper and tend to reduce the quantity of money used by the people as a medium of exchange, as a medium of deferred payments and as a store of value. Despite the fact that near money assets do not possess ready liquidity, they are preferred by individuals. According to Professor A. G. Hart, near money is preferred to cash by individuals because it serves as a margin of safety motive. Professor Dean points out that 80% of near money in the USA is held by individuals. The tremendous growth of near money assets in the United States is due to the fact that the yield from them is higher than from demand deposits and that they are safer than cash. Moreover, savings in the near money assets have been encouraged by such special techniques as to pay roll saving plan and commercial banks plan covering automatic regular transfer to specified sums from the demand to time deposits of the customers. Inside money and outside money. Gurley and Shaw, note 10, J.G. Gurley and E.S. Shaw, Money in a Theory of Finance, 1960. Gurley and Shaw have divided the total quantity of money in the economy into two parts, inside money and outside money. They define inside money as money based on the debt of endogenous economic units. It is money created within the private sector against some private debt. It consists of financial claims by one class of individuals and firms on others within the economy. When banks create deposits through loans and advances, these return to them as secondary deposits. Deposits and loans represent assets and liabilities of the private sector. On the other hand, outside money comes from outside the private sector. It is defined as money based on the debt of a unit, that is the government, exogenous to the system. Thus, it is currency issued by the government, gold, foreign and government securities. It is the liability of the government as a debtor and claim of the private sector as a creditor. The distinction between inside and outside money is important from many viewpoints. First, we study the importance of the distinction between the two in a period of rising or falling prices. When there is inflation or deflation, a change in the purchasing power of money, in the case of inside money, leads to an equal change in the real values of both assets and liabilities of the private sector. Thus, a change in the price level does not affect the behavior of depositors and borrowers possessing inside money. The monetary system also does not gain or lose in real terms by such changes in the real amount of its debts, because there is an equal change in the real value of its claims against firms. Given the nominal amount of inside money, its real value varies inversely with the price level. In other words, a change in the price level does not lead to a wealth transfer between the private sector and the government. Instead, it results only in a wealth transfer between consumers and firms, the former gaining and the latter losing when the price level falls and vice versa. This transfer is a distribution effect of instability in the price level. But such a change in the price level when money is of the inside variety does not affect government behavior and has no net effect on total wealth in the private sector. Page 184. GAs have shown that in this system, the price level is determinate. A departure from the initial equilibrium price level sets in motion forces which tend to restore the initial level or a new equilibrium price level. For instance, when the price level rises, it disturbs the portfolio equilibrium of the private sector by decreasing its real money holdings relative to its bond holdings. At the new price level, there will be excess real demand for money, excess real supply of bonds and goods, so that the system reverts back to the initial price level and the initial stock of nominal bonds. This will induce sales in the bond market to raise the interest rate and expenditure in the commodity market to raise the price level. The increase in the interest rate would have a depressing effect through commodity market, thereby bringing back the initial price level and vice versa in case of deflation. In the case of outside money, when prices rise, the real value of cash held by exogenous economic units falls. On the contrary, when prices fall, the real value of cash held by economic units rises. Thus, a change in the price level affects the behavior of economic units possessing outside money. Thus, given the nominal amount of outside money, its real value varies inversely with the price level, and each change in its real value leads to a wealth transfer between the private sector and the government sector. This wealth transfer affects private demands for money, goods, and labor, but not the government demand. When money is of outside variety, its impact is neutral on the real variables of the economy. A monetary change causes an equi-proportionate change in prices. As a result, relative prices and interest rates would remain unchanged. An expansion in the nominal stock of outside money causes excess supply in a money market and excess demand in the commodity market. This leads to the rise in price level above its initial level. The price rise reduces the aggregate real wealth of the private sector and a decline in the real value of its government debt. This brings down the real demands in all markets, which restore the initial price level. In this process, there is a wealth transfer between the private sector and the government, which has a net effect on aggregate demands for money, goods, and labor. Neutrality and non-neutrality of money. Neutrality of money. Neutrality of money means that money is neutral in its effects on economy. A change in the money stock can have no long-run influences on the level of real output, employment, rate of interest, or the composition of final output. The only lasting impact of a change in the money stock is to alter the general price level. Patinkin explains the neutrality of money as a situation when a uniformly introduced increase in the quantity of money causes a proportionate increase in the equilibrium price of commodities and leaves the equilibrium rate of interest unaffected, provided there is a balance of money illusion and distribution effects. Note 11, D. Patinkin, Interest and Prices, 2nd edition, 1965. According to Gurley and Shaw, money is neutral if money is either entirely of the outside variety or entirely of the inside variety. They define neutrality of money as the inability of changes in the nominal stock of money to affect the rate of interest, output, and wealth, and other variables. In other words, money is neutral if it does not affect relative prices and leaves the interest rate unaffected. All prices move equi-proportionally. If this happens without a time lag, the neutrality of money is instantaneous. If there is a time lag, there is long-run neutrality. These are changes in absolute money prices, but individual economic units are unresponsive to them. The quantity of money determines only absolute prices, and the level does not affect the level of income, interest, rate of capital formation, and employment. It is in this sense that money is neutral in its effects on the working of the economy. In the classical system, money is neutral in its effects on economy. It plays no role in the determination of employment, income, and output. Rather, they are determined by labor, capital stock, state of technology, availability of natural resources, saving habits of the people, and so on. In the classical system, the main function of money is to act as a medium of exchange. It is to determine the general level of prices at which goods and services will be exchanged. The quantity theory of money states that price level is a function of the supply of money. Algebraically, MV is equal to PT, where M, V, P, and T are the supply of money, velocity of money, price level, and volume of transactions or total output respectively. The equation tells that the total money supply MV equals the total value of output PT in the economy. Assume V and T to be constant, a change in M causes a proportionate change in P. Thus money is neutral, whose main function is to determine the general price level at which goods and services exchange. Page 185. In the entire Keynesian system, there are two situations in which money is neutral. The first is the situation of full employment, when any increase in the quantity of money brings about a proportionate increase in the price level, but output remains unchanged at that level. The second is a special case of liquidity trap. When the economy is in the liquidity trap, there cannot be a further fall in the rate of interest, even if the money supply is increased by monetary authorities. This implies that there will be no effect on such real variables as investment and income, and all changes in the money supply are added to idle balances. In this situation, money is neutral. However, money is non-neutral in the intermediate situation between these two extreme cases in the Keynesian system. Non-neutrality of money. In the Keynesian system, so long as there is unemployment, changes in the money supply produce permanent non-neutral effects on the rate of interest, the level of employment, income and output, the rate of capital formation, and so on. Thus, Keynes emphasized non-neutral money, and for this he invoked the monetary theory of interest. He wrote, "As soon as we pass the problem of what determines output and employment as a whole, we require the complete theory of a monetary economy." The post-Keynesians, particularly Friedman, Berner and Metzler, have shown that money is non-neutral in the short run. According to Friedman, interest rates cannot be used as a guide to monetary policy, and that an acceleration in the growth of rate of money supply produces not lower interest rates but higher ones, if the entire cycle of events is considered. Thus, monetary policy cannot peg interest rates except for limited periods. Any attempt to do so will only produce sustained inflation, just as would a similar attempt to use monetary policy to hold unemployment below its natural rate. Besides, Friedman also believes that money may be non-neutral in the long run. If there is a permanent acceleration in the growth rate of the money supply, say from 3% to 8%, it will permanently change the level of real income. This implies non-neutrality of money. This view presupposes that 1. Real money balances are a productive factor to business and provider of utility to the wealth holder, and 2. Inflation reduces the real balances with business and wealth holder. Functions of money. Money performs a number of primary, secondary, contingent and other functions which not only remove the difficulties of barter but also oils the wheels of trade and industry in the present day world. We discuss these functions one by one. 1. Primary functions. The two primary functions of money are to act as a medium of exchange and as a unit of value. Money as a medium of exchange. This is the primary function of money because it is out of this function that its other functions developed. By serving as a medium of exchange, money removes the need for a double coincidence of wants and the inconveniences and difficulties associated with barter. The introduction of money as a medium of exchange decomposes the single transaction of barter into separate transactions of sale and purchase, thereby eliminating the double coincidence of wants. This function of money also separates the transactions in time and place, because the sellers and buyers of a commodity are not required to perform the transactions at the same time and place. This is because the seller of a commodity buys some money in return buys the commodity over time and place. When money acts as a medium of exchange, it means that it is generally acceptable. It therefore affords the freedom of choice. With money we can buy an assorted bundle of goods and services. At the same time, we can purchase the best and also bargain in the market. Thus, money gives us a good deal of economic independence and also perfects the market mechanism by increasing competition and widening the market. As a medium of exchange, money acts as an intermediary. It facilitates exchange. It helps production indirectly through specialization and division of labor, which in turn increase efficiency and output. According to Professor Walters, money serves as a factor of production, enabling output to increase and diversify. In the last analysis, money facilitates trade. When acting as the intermediary, it helps one good or service to be traded indirectly for others. Page 186. Money as a unit of value. Note 12. This function is known by various other names such as unit of account, standard of value, common measure of value, or common denominator of value. The second primary function of money is to act as unit of value. Under barter, one would have to resort to some standard of measurement, such as a length of string or a piece of wood. Since one would have to use a standard to measure the length or height of an object, it is only sensible that one particular standard should be accepted as the standard. Money is the standard for measuring value, just as a yard or meter is the standard for measuring length. Money is the standard for measuring value. The monetary unit measures and expresses the value of all goods and services. In fact, it expresses the value of each good or service in terms of price. Money is the common denominator, which determines the rate of exchange between goods and services, which are priced in terms of the monetary unit. There can be no pricing process without a measure of value. The use of money as a standard of value eliminates the necessity of quoting the price of apples in terms of oranges, the price of oranges in terms of nuts, and so on. Unlike barter, the prices of such commodities are expressed in terms of so many units of dollars, rupees, francs, pounds, etc., depending on the nature of the monetary unit in a country. As a matter of fact, measuring the values of goods and services in the monetary unit facilitates the problem of measuring the exchange values of goods in the market. When values are expressed in terms of money, the number of prices are reduced from n into n minus 1 in the barter economy to n minus 1 in the monetary economy. Money as a unit of value also facilitates accounting when assets of all kinds, liabilities of all kinds, incomes of all kinds, and expenses of all kinds can be stated in terms of common monetary units to be added or subtracted. Further, money as a unit of account helps in calculations of economic importance, such as the estimation of the costs and revenues of business firms, the relative costs and profitability of various public enterprises and projects under a planned economy, and the gross national product. As pointed out by Culbertson, prices quoted in terms of money become the focus of people's behavior. Their calculations, plans, expectations, and contracts focus on money prices. Note 13. J. M. Culbertson, Money and Banking, 1972. 2. Secondary functions. Money performs three secondary functions: as a standard of deferred payments, as a store of value, and as a transfer of value. They are discussed below. 1. Money as a standard of deferred payments. The third function of money is that it acts as a standard of deferred or postponed payments. All debts are taken in money. It was easy under barter to make loans in goods or grains, but difficult to make repayments in such perishable articles in the future. Money has simplified both the taking and repayment of loans because the unit of account is durable. Money links the present value with those of the future. It simplifies credit transactions. It makes possible contracts for the supply of goods in the future for an agreed payment of money. It simplifies borrowing by consumers on higher purchase and from house building and cooperative societies. Money facilitates borrowing by firms and businessmen from banks and non-bank financial institutions. The buying and selling of shares, debentures, and securities is made possible by money. By acting as a standard of deferred payments, money helps in capital formation, both by the government and business enterprises. In fine, this function of money develops financial and capital markets and helps in the growth of the economy. But there is the danger of changes in the value of money over time which harm or benefit the creditors and debtors. If the value of money increases over time, the creditors gain and debtors lose. On the other hand, a fall in the value of money over time brings losses to creditors and windfalls to debtors. 2. Money is a store of value. Another important function of money is that it acts as a store of value. The good chosen as money is always something which can be kept for long periods without deterioration or wastage. It is a form in which wealth can be kept intact from one year to the next. Money is a bridge from the present to the future. It is therefore essential that money commodity should always be one which can be easily and safely stored. Note 14, A. W. Stonier and D. C. Haig, opposite, page 406. Money as a store of value is meant to meet unforeseen emergencies and to pay debts. Nivlin calls this the asset function of money. Money is not, of course, the only store of value. This function can be served by any valuable asset. Page 187. One can store value for the future by holding short-term promissory notes, bonds, mortgages, preferred stocks, household furniture, houses, land, or any kind of valuable goods. The principal advantages of these other assets as a store of value are that they, unlike money, originally yield an income in the form of interest, profits, rents, or usefulness, and they sometimes rise in value in terms of money. On the other hand, they have certain disadvantages as a store of value, among which are the following. They sometimes involve storage costs. They may depreciate in terms of money, and they are illiquid in varying decreases, for they are not generally acceptable as money, and it may be possible to convert them into money quickly only by offering a loss of value. Note 15, W. T. Newlin, Theory of Money, 2nd edition, Chapter 1. Keynes placed much emphasis on this function of money. According to him, to hold money is to keep it as a reserve of liquid assets which can be converted into real goods. It is a matter of comparative indifference whether the wealth is in money, money claims, or goods. In fact, money and money claims have certain advantages of security, convenience, and adaptability over real goods. But the store of value function of money also suffers from changes in the value of money. This introduces considerable hazard in using money or assets as a store of value. 3. Money is a transfer of value. Since money is a generally acceptable means of payment and acts as a store of value, it keeps on transferring values from person to person and place to place. A person who holds money in cash or assets can transfer that to any other person. Moreover, he can sell his assets at Delhi and purchase fresh assets in Bangalore. Thus, money facilitates transfer of value between persons and places. 3. Contingent functions. Money also performs certain contingent or incidental functions. According to Professor David Kinley, they are 1. Money is the most liquid of all assets. Money is the most liquid of all liquid assets in which wealth is held. Individuals and firms may hold liquid in infinitely varied forms. They may, for example, choose between holding wealth in currency, demand deposits, time deposits, savings, bonds, treasury bills, short-term government securities, long-term government securities, debentures, preference shares, ordinary shares, stocks of consumer goods and productive equipment. All these are liquid forms of wealth which can be converted into money and vice versa. 2. Basis of the credit system. Money is the basis of the credit system. Business transactions are either in cash or on credit. credit economizes the use of money, but money is at the back of all credit. A commercial bank cannot create credit without giving sufficient money in reserve. The credit instruments drawn by businessmen have always a cash guarantee supported by their bankers. 3. Equalizer of marginal utilities and productivities. Money acts as an equalizer of marginal utilities for the consumer. The main aim of a consumer is to maximize his installations by spending a given sum of money on various goods which he wants to purchase. Since prices of goods indicate their marginal utilities and are expressed in money, money helps in equalizing the marginal utilities of various goods. This happens when the ratios of marginal utilities and prices of various goods are equal. 4. Equalizer of marginal productivities. Money also helps in equalizing marginal productivities of various factors. The main aim of the producer is to maximize his profits. For this, he equalizes the marginal productivity of each factor with its price. The price of each factor is nothing but the money he receives for his work. 5. Measurement of national income. It is not possible to measure national income under the barter system. Money helps in measuring national income. This is done when various goods and services produced in a country are assessed in money terms. 6. Distribution of national income. Money also helps in the distribution of national income. Rewards of factors of production in the form of wages, rent, interest and profit are determined and paid in terms of money. 4. Other functions. Money also performs such functions which affect the decisions of consumers and governments. Page 188. 1. Helping in making decisions. Money as a means of store of value helps a consumer meet his daily requirements on the basis of money held by him. If the consumer has a scooter and he needs a car in the near future, he can buy a car by selling his scooter and money accumulated by him. In this way, money helps in taking decisions. 2. Money as a basis of adjustment. To carry on trade in a proper manner, the adjustment between money market and capital market is done through money. Similarly, adjustments in foreign exchange are also made through money. Further, international payments of various types are also adjusted and made through money. It is on the basis of these functions that money guarantees the solvency of the payer and provides options to the holder of money to use it any way he likes. Selected readings. L. V. Chandler and S. M. Goldfield, The Economics of Money and Banking, 7th edition, 1977. G. Grauther, An Outline of Money, 1958. W. T. Newlin, Theory of Money, 2nd edition, Chapter 1. G. J. Gurley and S. E. Shaw, Money in a Theory of Finance, 1960. Exercises. 1. Discuss the meaning and nature of money. Money is what money does. How far do you agree with this definition of money? 3. How is money different from other liquid assets? 4. Distinguish between money and near money assets. 5. Distinguish between inside money and outside money. 6. Explain neutrality of money. When is money non-neutral? And 7. Briefly explain the functions of money.